Imperfect leaders. Are you facing challenges filling open speech language pathologist positions within your district? It's kind of a silly question because I know you are. Empath Speech understands the critical need for qualified professionals in your schools. They recognize that communication lies at the heart of academic success, and that's why they're dedicated to helping you bridge the gap by offering expert therapists and innovative telehealth solutions. Don't let open positions hinder your students' success. Partner with Empath Speech today and ensure every child in your district has access to the speech therapy they deserve. Empath Speech, empathspeech.com. Empowering students, empowering schools. Welcome to another episode of An Imperfect Leader. And what a day. Today, I attended a fireside chat between NSBA's executive director, Virginia McCotter-Jacobs, and civil rights icon, Ruby Bridges. You know, until I heard Ruby tell her story, I just assumed everyone knew who she was. She said it wasn't until 1995 that she sort of revealed herself to the world. Up until then, we knew the photograph of the little girl, 6 years old, integrating her New Orleans elementary school, and we knew of the Norman Rockwell painting of that same little girl holding the hands of law enforcement who were enforcing the law, integrating her school in 1960, 6 years after Brown versus the Board of Education decision. I stood in awe of Ruby and her message for leaders today to keep working for a more just world. And this is, I think, the perfect intro for my guest today, Dr. Monique Darsa-Akil, the superintendent of the Uniondale School District on Long Island. Now, she talks about lagging graduation rates and below average proficiency scores and outdated infrastructure as what she encountered as she began working in the district. But she was also inheriting a great plan, and so she talks about that. And she says, you know what, we can do better. And she and her team, they did just that. And in fact, in the second part, you know, in the after-action review, we discussed the adoption of a tech product and how the rollout, well, it didn't go as she had planned. Here was a tool that was going to revolutionize the system that they were working on while they launched it, and it wasn't good. It's a great episode. I am so thrilled to introduce to you Dr. Monique Darsa-Akil.
I'm Peter Stiefelman, and this is An Imperfect Leader.
Today on An Imperfect Leader, Dr. Monique Darsa-Akil, superintendent of the Uniondale School District, is my guest. And I want to tell you why I had to talk to Dr. Akil. This is what I read in the Long Island Herald. Residents throughout Uniondale will tell you, this community, once grappling with educational challenges that seemed insurmountable, has undergone a remarkable transformation under the leadership of the Herald Beacon's inaugural Person of the Year, Monique Darsa-Akil, the superintendent of the Uniondale School District. Monique, welcome to An Imperfect Leader.
Hi, Peter. How are you? Thanks for having me.
I'm so pleased to meet you. And, you know, you're on Long Island. I'm from Long Island, South Shore. But, you know, I've spent so much time in my youth going to Uniondale to Islanders games, Arrows games, concerts, I think the Big Apple Circus at one point. But I am so thrilled to meet you. And this is why. When you took over Uniondale, as I read and learned more, it faced so many challenges. It had lagging graduation rates. It had below average proficiency scores. It had outdated infrastructure. And you've been credited with orchestrating this massive cultural and educational shift, including the addition of additional student resources. And I wonder, you know, so many district leaders face similar daunting tasks and really are not sure like where to begin. Would you talk about the process you used to, I like to use the term agitate for change, right? Agitate for meaningful and enduring change. Yeah. So would you talk a little bit about your work there?
Oh, sure. I love that. Agitate. Perfect description. So first, I think framing is everything. And while I very humbly accept, you know, the accolades, I do think the kind of rags to riches story is a little not quite accurate to where we are, right? So I came into a school district that had so many wonderful things happening, strong, stable, consistent leaders, you know, caring relationships with not only the students, but also the community, and definitely on an upward trajectory. And you have to also think that when I came in, we were really still in the pandemic, moving out of it. So some of the data that was stagnant, I would say, you know, is very typical of what, you know, schools were going through all across the country. So while there have been successes, I am very careful to frame and also to provide context that there wasn't a meteoric rise. If there wasn't a solid foundation of community support, clear visionary leadership from our Board of Education and our leaders and staff that was there, we wouldn't have been able to get any of the gains we've had so far. So I just want to kind of set up that frame that feels more authentic to what really took place.
Yeah. Otherwise, it's sort right. of like that waiting for Superman kind of thing, right? So
yeah.
So, yeah.
Definitely not where we are. You know, Uniondale is such a unique community. You know, graduation rates were in the low to mid 80s, and just, you know, we're moving up. Our attendance rates are moving up. We've done a lot of work around college and career access, and we're definitely working on increasing our literacy and numeracy rates, you know, as measured on state assessments as well as our own local measures. So we have seen gains, but again, the district was already positioned to make those gains. But, you know, to answer your question in terms of like, what are some of the things that we did was one, I think you have to know your numbers, right? So my analogy always is if you set a goal, a fitness goal, a weight goal, whatever goal you set, you really have to step on the scale and say, where are we today? So I think being very clear and clear without judgment, right? I think that's very, very important. Like whatever your number is, that's your number. Whatever our reading scores are, that's where we are. It doesn't mean you are a bad leader. Doesn't mean the teachers are not good. Doesn't mean the kids are not good. It just means this is where we are right now. But I think that when you come into districts and, you know, we talk and there's all these euphemisms and excuses that are being made without really looking at the data, then you really can't have a clear path forward. So that is something that I was very, very clear about. Where are we now? What's our baseline? Where do we want to go next? And how do we really partner with those who are here, parents, community, students, leaders, teachers that have been here for a really long time? How do we partner with them and really use their expertise? Because as a new leader coming in, right, we all think, you know, you're coming in, we're going to change stuff, we're going to transform. But when they say that the answer is in the room, I believe that in schools too. There are teachers who are waiting to be asked, what do you think we could do to change math instruction in our school? How can we better serve our ENL students? The answers are in the room. They're waiting to be listened to. So I think you take that information, you listen, you listen, you listen, you curate all this information, and then you say, hey, how do we align what you're thinking with where we want to go? And of course, evidence-based practices, right? Not that gut intuition, but like, where has it already been successful in communities like this? And, you know, set a clear plan in place that everyone can rally behind. So one of our first initiatives was around creating a strategic plan. And I think people are really proud of it because they see themselves and their voices in it. It's not just Monique's vision, Dr. Akil's vision, the board's vision. It's really parents can see their voice. Students can say, we wanted it this way. And that's what you see in that vision. And I also, you know, I think we go into school systems and we tell folks, we need you to change 20 things. If you've, you know, been a professional observer, and that in of itself is, you know, really, really kind of crazy on some level, right? That I'm going to sit and watch you work and give you coaching feedback. Okay.
Right. That feedback is typically coaching for compliance, and feedback is not seen as constructive, but rather destructive, isn't it?
It can be done very well, yeah. But I don't
sure.
know.
Sure. But are you, I think I was responding to making right. a career out of it as opposed to right. peer right. coaching, right? I'm walking in these shoes with you. I know what you're going through. We can do this together. That appreciative lens of what's going well and how do we get more of it. And you're speaking to harvesting that collective wisdom of your community. And I love how you talked about student voice. I mean, these are children who are going to absolutely inherit your school district, potentially as parents in your district. So shouldn't they have a voice in what they learn and what their children are going to learn down the road? Oh my gosh. It seems novel. It shouldn't be. It should be like normal, like course of action, but it isn't always.
You know, I think that that's really important that, you know, when we go into classrooms or, you know, and we give teachers feedback and support that we really go in with the inquiry stance. And I think we approach everything, whether it's conversation with students, conversation with parents, like the level of humility I believe leaders have to have. And we're not good at it, right? Because you get to this job because someone says you're good, you're hot stuff, right? And so we're constantly being inflated. And the other thing I have learned is the higher you move up in leadership, the less critical feedback that you get. So all of a sudden, all your jokes are funny, and all of a sudden, all your ideas are great. Like, where do we really get feedback about our work? So I think we have to have a degree of humility when we, you know, talk to teachers and talk to students and families and really have a serious inquiry-based stance in leading this work.
So I get the fact that, as you described, the sort of cultural field, right, the way that the district feels and was sort of primed and ready to move forward, and that you happened to come in at a time where you were ready to lead, your team was ready, your teachers craved the opportunity to give you authentic and genuine feedback and advice, and you took that and crafted, and I love the word curated that you used, but you crafted this strategic plan that made a lot of sense. I think there's a piece to give you credit for, which is I noticed that there was an increase in the rates of higher level coursework for students, that increase. And that had to have been something that came from both you and your team and your teachers saying our children are smart, that they are capable, and that we have been maybe selling them short. And I wonder, why is it important to invest in programming like AP coursework? You know, the kinds of higher level courses that we sometimes see missing in districts and communities that need them the most.
So, I mean, I'm glad you say that, because for me, that's at the heart of the equity agenda, right? So a lot of people talk the talk around equity, and it means, you know, it's one of those words like scaffolding, differentiation, science of reading, like, you know, fill in the blank, whatever that term is, it can mean everything and nothing, you know, all at the same time. But so for me, equity is about, you know, opportunity gaps, like who has opportunities to make choices and decisions that will prepare them to be a leader and who doesn't. Like I always say, some students are being prepared to lead. Others are being prepared to be employed and to follow. Right. And so we want to like flip the script and make sure that all kids, right, regardless of their background, of whatever label they were given at sometimes 5 years old, at 5 years old, somebody put some kid in a lower reading group and said, right now, you're not reading where the other five-year-olds are reading. So therefore, you're in a lower reading group. And that becomes a trap. It comes a track and a trap. And then as a system, we just keep feeding this notion of this placement decision that was made by someone when they were five or when they were eight or whatever. So, you know, this idea of higher coursework, and I love that you called out, whether it's AP or Cambridge or IB or whatever it is, it's saying that, one, we believe in the inherent genius of all children. I do not believe that there is a distribution of intelligence in one community versus the other. I believe that it has been equally distributed across all demographics, across all language groups, across its socioeconomic statuses, right? It has been equally distributed. So if we really, really believe that, then we say, now what's the barrier between certain students having access and not just, you know, being there? Like Bettina Love says, you know, we don't just want to survive, we want to thrive. So I don't want to just put kids in an AP class and they're like paddling, and then we reinforce this notion that they just don't have.
Right. Right. And this idea, this imposter syndrome. Why did they tell me I could do this coursework? Right.
And I'm struggling. I'm drowning. I had 90 averages in general ed classes. And now you put me in this class and my average is a 60. Like, what's up with that? Right.
Right. So, and we will say to a child, but you know what? You know, getting a C in this class means that you're going to be able to complete college. They go, complete college? I got to get into college and I can't get in with a 60. So help me out.
Tell a parent that. Right.
Right.
So to me, like opening the access to these courses, one, affirms, like puts our actions behind the stated beliefs around equity and access to opportunities for all students. It also challenges some of the adult beliefs about high performing, capable student can do. And so one of the things that we see is that the way we make these decisions are not always norms and systems. So sometimes we make these decisions around placement in higher courses based on grade point averages. Well, that's not it's not totally objective. As a matter of fact, it's very subjective. It could be how you speak. It could be what parent emails you and gives you, you know, lots of affirmation. We have to challenge adult behaviors. We have to challenge how we are providing opportunities to students. We have to talk to students. And, you know, when we talk about student voice, you know, students had very strong reactions. Some said, I don't want to take this class. It's hard. It doesn't appeal to me. You can't tell me that AP Calc is something I'm going to need. I don't want it. And we definitely had to talk to parents and community and to say, this is why we think this is something your child should have a right to. And my, you know, saying, but I've been quoted like numerous times saying, this kid can't break AP. I promise you, there is nothing that this 14-year-old can do that's going to break our program, right? What it might mean is that we're going to have to provide this kid with some summer supports so they can be ready. So we do have boot camp programs for kids entering into Algebra 2 and trigonometry saying, you know, we know you have the potential, but for you to go there and do well, again, thrive, not just survive, you're going to need an extra boost. And so we select the teachers that really are like high relational teachers. So it's not just about teaching your subject. It's about making kids feel confident and strong and empowered and bringing that joy. So we like really carefully select those teachers and say, we know that you not only are great at math, you're not only great at science and chem, but you also are like connecting. You're the kid whisperer. That if you tell a kid you believe in them, they're going to be like, yeah, okay, I wasn't going to do it, but because you said it, I'm going to do it. And not only that, we look for students who've already done it, right? So this idea of first gen and overcoming, it has a lot to do with, you know, who else in the family? And I like to have a more expansive view of the family. What other Latino male, Salvadorian male has been successful in AP Chem in our school right now? And then we bring them in and we pay them. And you're going to be the tutors for those kids. Mm. So not only am I looking at my teacher, I'm looking at a peer who's 1 year ahead of me who's saying, yeah, dude, I did this.
How does the term an imperfect leader resonate with you?
I think that's my daily walk. I think that leaders, good leaders, are always thinking about what can they do better. And so in order to think about what's the new goal, what's the new next level of work, you're thinking about what you haven't done yet, what you haven't accomplished yet. And I think there is a danger of never, you know, sitting back and appreciating what you have accomplished. But I do believe an imperfect leader is one who's always reflecting, always searching internally, always holding themselves accountable, thinking about behaviors, thinking about mindsets, open to learning, but recognizing that none of us, no matter what award, no matter what accolade, none of us has arrived. As long as there's one child who leaves our school system without a plan for their future, doesn't feel safe in school, whether it's our transgender, LGBTQ, and expansive youth, as long as there's one child who feels like school didn't feel safe today, school wasn't affirming for me today, then we still have work to do. And I believe the imperfect leader recognizes that.
And we'll be right back. Hey, district leaders, I know you already know this. In schools worldwide, cell phones are posing real challenges on student engagement and mental well-being. And I want you to meet Yonder, a proud sponsor of an imperfect leader. And let me share this story from a visit I made to some schools in Silicon Valley. I asked some kids what they liked about Yonder, and after some funny looks, they shared that actually, with Yonder, teachers don't have to battle with them over phones anymore. In fact, one kid said to me he didn't have to worry anymore about his parents texting him in class, and the kid next to him like sort of shoved him and goes, texting? My mom used to FaceTime me in class. I want to introduce you to a support system that increases teaching and learning. I want you to discover why a million students choose Yonder daily. Minimize distractions. Maximize learning potential. To learn more, go to overyonder.com. Y-O-N-D-R. We're back for segment two of an imperfect leader called Imperfect Leadership in After Action. And my guest is Dr. Monique Darceau-Akil, the superintendent of the Uniondale School District in Uniondale, New York. And in this segment, we ask our guests to deconstruct a decision that they made, and then we discuss it. So Monique, what happened?
So there was a tech product that we introduced in our district. I got some guidance from team members that this particular tech product was going to revolutionize a system that we were working through. And, you know, I have this theory of rollout that has worked well for me. You know, we talked about it with our leaders. We piloted it with our teachers, told the board we were going to move forward. And so we launched in the beginning of a school year. And I was like, okay, great. This is good. And almost immediately we were getting feedback. This is not good. And I said, as much as I thought, I think I'm very strategic about rolling out new products, you know, and everyone wants to be forward, right? We don't want to stay stagnant. And I do know that sometimes in a launch of a new initiative, there's always going to be pain. There's always going to be people who are resistant to change. And so I have a tolerance for that to a certain degree, but something just wasn't working. Because those voices were just getting louder and louder and louder. And for a while, I thought I underestimated and characterized this resistance as, oh, well, people just don't want to change. They liked what they had. They're, you know, slow tech adopters. So they're just complaining. And so then I said, you know what? Instead of thinking this is an adaptive challenge, I said, okay, I'm going to throw more technical solutions. So I said, okay, more training. This is what they need. More training. Just give them more training. So we set about getting more training. All right, we're going to have parent trainings. We're going to pay folks to come to open school nights and, you know, do trainings. We're going to flood the teachers with more training. And I was hearing more from board members who are parents, from teachers saying, this is more complicated than our old system. And then we had students who said, and students who I know are diligent, who are hard workers, saying, before I used to be able to see my coursework and see how well I'm doing, now it just seems harder. And I think I was resistant, and I think I just let it go too long before saying, wait a minute. I'm getting from every stakeholder group that this is not working. Why am I holding on? And at some point, I just said, enough. This is not working. And I had to abandon this initiative. And in doing so was costly because I don't know if you know, but once you enter into a contract agreement with, you know, most vendors, they don't just say, oh, well, you don't like it. You know, fine, we'll just take our marbles and go home. So we had to fulfill the contractual obligations for the remainder of the term of service. But I made a decision that if this is not working for my families, it's not working for our teachers. And the goal was to make this easier for teachers to communicate with parents and students. And we're getting the opposite of that, according to our stakeholder groups. I'm going to stop it in its track. So I had to go to my board and say, this is going to cost us money, but I believe that this is a mistake. I had to go to the community and say, I forced something on you that I thought I had gotten a lot of input and feedback on, but obviously not enough. We didn't do any beta testing. We didn't roll it out slow.
That's
enough.
What I'm going to get to. Okay. Wait.
Yeah. So all the things.
Oh, you're on a roll now.
I could do it now because I have a little bit of like perspective.
Right. No, I mean, this is such a valuable topic. And when I think about
it, tell the tale.
I would say, though, you know, so many of our listeners who listen to this podcast are those who are aspiring, who are in ed courses or ed leadership courses and are thinking about taking the plunge into leadership or district-wide leadership, those who are new to the field, and then those who are experienced who say, you know, I'm curious to see how other people are doing this work. And this is such a valuable topic because, yes, so many of us move into or make a decision about an initiative that we believe is going to be great for our kids and our families and for the adults in the system that are serving children. And we have a process that we believe will work, and sometimes we overlook things. And so I'm curious, you were getting to it, what got overlooked?
So I definitely think we didn't start small enough. We rolled out to the entire district. That I think is problematic. I think doing a small beta test, a swab test, right? So you paint your whole room. Most times they tell you try like a little patch on the wall before you just, you know, submit to Desert Red for your entire living room, right? So we didn't do that. And I think that if we had done that, we would have gotten a little bit more insight about how this really worked in real time. So I think that was the biggest flaw when I look back at it. And I'm going to say, as much as I trust my team, because, you know, they're the closest ones to the work, making the decisions, I probably should have also looked, where else is this happening? You know, with the beauty of the internet, you can either, even if you don't go physically to another school district to see how it works, we could have visited virtually to see. So we didn't do that at all. We just kind of went in blindly. And then we launched in the beginning of the school year, where all good things happen at the same time, and expected that everyone was going to be ready, and they weren't. And then the thing I would say lastly is I just let a bad situation go for too long. You know, again, making assumptions about the complaints, thinking that if I give up now, then every decision I make is going to be negotiable.
I think that's a reasonable thing to be considering and a reasonable way to look back and say, you know, now what I know about this community and the people I lead, that I didn't need to worry about that. That, in fact, I was going to gain credibility by being able to admit that there could have been a better way to do this.
I mean, I really can't stress that enough, because, you know, of course, there are going to be some people say, oh, we told you so. I mean, there's always going to be that. But the majority of the people, when I went into a faculty room and told teachers, I said, you know what, we've heard you. This is hard. We spent money on this. But my job is to remove obstacles from you, to remove operational barriers from you. And I didn't do that. And I'm sorry. And we're going to stop doing this thing to you. We're going to stop imposing this thing on you. And they clapped. And I believe that that transparency, that vulnerability, I gained more than ever in terms of people buying into my leadership, because I was able to say, I made a mistake. And I stood in front of it. And I'll just say that you're talking about advice. I'm not blaming anyone. I signed off on it at the end. So whether if it goes well, I'm probably going to be in the front of it. If it doesn't go well, I am in the front of it. I did not say, oh, you know, they let me down the wrong path. I signed off on it. And I'm going to admit that there was a mistake as the leader of the organization. And I believe that people respected that. I did. No one got fired. And there's an expression, no one died. Right. And that says a lot about your leadership, that if someone makes a mistake, how do you as a leader treat them? No one got fired. No one got a public reprimand. Listen, I want you to be a risk taker. And in taking risks, sometimes it's going to be, you know, failures, or there's going to be problems. But if I say that everything you do has to be perfect, no one's ever going to take a risk, and we're going to stay stagnant.
What did you learn about relationships?
I learned how important honesty and integrity and vulnerability are from the leaders. I learned what mutual respect looks like in real time.
In the end, and I think you have said this so beautifully, so there may be nothing to add, but I want to ask it anyway, because this experience most likely impacted the way that you led following this situation. And so in the end, what was something that was good that came out of this event?
There's an expression, go slow to go fast. And I think, especially for new leaders, there's this pressure to excel during the honeymoon period and to get early wins. Slow it down and communicate. This is what we're doing. This is why we're doing it. This is what we hope to gain. Don't overpromise, but slow it down. It's okay to slow it down so that when you ask your community to make a huge shift, they are with you. And I'll reference a leader, you know, whose legacy has been debated, but David Dinkins, the first African-American mayor of New York City, you know, people would pepper him with all these questions and interviews and say all these things. And it was like a tennis match. He would be so deliberate and thoughtful in his responses that no matter how fast you spoke at him, he would slow it down. And that always stuck with me. You do not have to move at the speed of light to appease whoever's questioning you. You as a leader can set the tone and the pace, and there's so much displays of confidence in doing so.
My guest today was Dr. Monique Darsaw-Akil, the superintendent of the Uniondale School District in Uniondale, New York. And Monique, I just want to thank you so much for sharing how leaders who lead with vulnerability, who lead with empathy, who lead with compassion, who honor the voices of staff and parents and children, well, they are the most exceptional leaders. And so thank you for being that model for us. And that last reminder there was so important to avoid the impulse to make a quick decision. We'll make more predictably successful decisions together when we do that, when we avoid that impulse and make decisions together. So thank you so much again for being a guest.
Thank you, Peter. It's been a pleasure.
Music for An Imperfect Leader was written and arranged by Ian Varley. Sam Falbo created our artwork, a wood print-inspired Daruma doll butterfly. Remember, imperfect leadership is not a scarlet letter. It's a badge of honor. It recognizes that serving as a lead learner is about being a vulnerable leader, an empathetic leader, a compassionate leader. And I'm proud to be an imperfect leader. I'm Peter Stiepelman. Please join me next time for another episode of An Imperfect Leader, Leadership in After Action.